From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 19th century, great opera was dominated by two superstars with very different visions of the world. Giuseppe Verdi, the great Italian composer with his soaring arias and his sweet strains brimming with the human condition. Richard Wagner, the thunderous German with his realm of the gods and ring cycle playing behind me right now. These two greats never met, but they lived and composed side by side in their age. Their art sprang from and helped define their cultures. Even now, their operas can be read as a kind of soundtrack to Europe's tensions. This hour on Point, Verdi versus Wagner, two greats, two views of the world. You can join the conversation. What will it be for you? Verdi, the lush humanist, Rigoletto, La Traviata, Wagner, the soul of the Übermensch, the ring cycle, the Valkyrie. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Peter Conrad, the great cultural critic, author of Modern Times, Modern Places, A Song of Love and Death, Creation, Artists, Gods, and Origins. His new book cracks open the legacies of two of opera's most powerful composers. It's titled Verdi and or Wagner, Two Men, Two Worlds, Two Centuries. Peter Conrad, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
Wonderful book and a wonderful subject. Anybody who's listened to these side by side, or even, you know, not side by side, any time in life, has two very different feelings coming from them. You remind us that Hollywood tends to pick them up and treat them as Wagner the terrorist and Verdi the therapist. Give us the source of those characterizations.
When you quote that back to me, it sounds a bit flip, but it's kind of true. I mean, what I was thinking of, obviously, was the use that Coppola makes of Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries in Apocalypse Now, mm-hmm. where the helicopters are wired for sound as they go out napalming the village to mm-hmm. give the gooks, as Colonel Kilgore mm-hmm. calls them, a dose of Wagner as the jungle goes up in flames. And simultaneously, I mean, you have this wonderful Hollywood fable about the redemptive power, the healing power of Verdi's music in Pretty Woman, when Richard Gere puts Julia Roberts, the Sunset Boulevard hooker, mm-hmm. into his private jet, takes her from L.A. to San Francisco to a performance of Traviata about a courtesan, I mean, a woman whose profession is the same as that of Julia Roberts in mm-hmm. the film, who's redeemed by love. And all of the hard edges of these two characters are smoothed off by the experience of listening to Verdi. Julia Roberts has never been inside an opera house before, but breaks down in sobs because she recognizes from the music the sympathy and tenderness that Verdi feels for all human beings. And she says to Adagio in the box next to her at the end of the performance, "I liked it so much I almost peed my pants," she says.
To put it
Which
right.
is real tribute to the emotional power of Verdi, I think.
It puts it right in the vernacular. We want to hear the music right. and kind of take the measure of these two men, these two amazing composers in this hour, and the contrast between them, maybe the same contrast we see sometimes at work right now in the Euro crisis playing out in North, South, and all the rest. But let's listen to a little bit on the Verdi side of the ledger here. The therapist, or the humanist, as you like, kind of the Shakespearean Verdi here. We've got a little bit from Rigoletto, Act 3. Tell us about, I think you know this piece. This is the quartet. This is the last act of Verdi's 1851 opera, Rigoletto. And it's got a kind of Shakespearean quality. You've said, Peter, he's got four people singing different emotions simultaneously. Well, let's listen, and then you can tell us a little of what we're hearing. There's Luciano Pavarotti right in the middle of Sutherland and Milne and Turango and kind of absolutely classic Verdi. What do we hear right
here?
Yeah,
it's a real tragicomedy, this little episode, because you have two characters who are experiencing a tragedy and who are both shortly going to be dead, and two characters for whom life is just a game, a joke. I mean, Joan Sutherland is playing the young woman who's been seduced and then abandoned by the libertine Duke, played by Pavarotti. Her father is chiding her for her misbehavior, but also trying to console her. She's just about to sacrifice herself, to throw her life away to save this man. And meanwhile, on the other side of a partition, the Duke is going through the business again and giving the same old hackneyed lyrical line to his latest conquest, the innkeeper's sister, Maddalena. So, the wonderful Shakespearean thing about it is that Verdi enables you to listen simultaneously to the thought streams through the voices of four people who are experiencing totally different things. And he manages to sympathize with all of them as well. I mean, in a spoken play, you hear one character at a time, and you listen just to one point of view at a time. But somehow music opens your mind up and opens your heart out, so you have room for all of these simultaneous points of view.
It's an absolutely incredible tapestry. And the heart of what it shows us about the humanist Verdi here and what he brings to this oppositional relationship, as you write it almost, Peter Conrad versus Wagner, what's the essence of Verdi here?
I think sympathy, tenderness, understanding, I mean, humanism, as I was saying. I mean, he was the great musician of the human condition. And often when asked about what he thought about Wagner, he would say, well, you know, I mean, Wagner writes about gods and goddesses and dwarves and snakes and demons and ogres of their dragons. I don't know any of these people. All I know is human beings, and all I can do is set to music the emotional life that all of us share. I mean, he's someone who's rooted on the ground and felt a sort of vocation to make sense of the emotional lives of his fellow human beings, whereas Wagner, the great metaphysician and mystic, you know, is interested in gods, interested in devils, but not very interested in the ordinary human beings who exist in between those two extremes.
Let's go straight to the Wagner side of the house then. Act 2, Scene 1 from Die Walküre. Act 2 from Wagner's 1856, Die Walküre there, second in the Ring cycle, with the great soprano Birgit Nilsson there as the Valkyrie Brunhilde. Now, these Valkyries reappropriated from Norse mythology, witches who soared around on aerial horses over the battlefield, took the bodies of the dead back up to reanimate them as ghosts. We're way into your mythic, metaphysical land here, Peter Conrad, with Wagner.
Yeah, it's pretty ghoulish stuff, this. I mean, what you just heard is a kind of tuned screaming, I suppose you could describe it as. I mean, it's as if she was one of those helicopters in Apocalypse Now in human form.
Yes.
And, I mean, what she's saying, I mean, behind all of that fusillade of high C's and B-flats and so on, is that she loves to be up in the air with the wind in her face, looking down at the carnage on the battlefield and ordering the horse to swoop down and pick up the cadaver of some victorious warrior or other. I mean, when the Twin Towers fell on 9/11, the German composer Stockhausen earned himself execration all over the world by saying that this spectacle was one of the greatest works of art for the whole cosmos. But, you know, I mean, I think if Wagner had been around, he might have thought something the same. I mean, there's a delight in violence and cruelty and death on a grand scale here.
Just incredible.
Which makes this very exciting, but also a bit scary,
yes,
I think.
A bit scary. And, of course, its 20th century echoes were a bit scary in themselves. Do you make the case that what we have here in Verdi and Wagner is the musical essence of these two cultures, German, Italian?
Well, that's the way it worked out historically, especially because Verdi wrote all of those great patriotic hymns that became the music of national liberation during the time when Italy was fighting to free itself from occupation by the Austrian Empire. And Wagner spent a lot of time trying to ingratiate with Bismarck and with the founders of the first German Empire and wanted to be seen as a great national composer. So they both have this national representativeness, I suppose. And yet the really fascinating thing about them as individuals is that neither of them fitted the national stereotype. That there was nothing very Latin about Verdi in his private behavior. I mean, he was very kind of glum and gloomy and self-contained and repressed person with a rather iron temperament, as his wife said. He saved all his emotional life for his music and his characters.
Hold it right there, if you would. We've got to go out to a short break here. The Ride of the Valkyries behind us. Talk about apocalypse now. Peter Conrad's new book is Verdi and/or Wagner, Two Men, Two Worlds, Two Centuries. Listeners, you can join us. Where would you line up? Where would you go to listen? The Verdi camp, the Wagner camp? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Verdi, lovely behind us right here, versus Wagner. We heard the Ride of the Valkyries on the way out. The opera terrorist, Wagner, versus the opera therapist, at least as Hollywood has had it. Peter Conrad is with us. His wonderful new book is Verdi and/or Wagner, Two Men, Two Worlds, Two Centuries. The German, Wagner, the Italian, Verdi, two greats and their different visions of life. They contended and competed while they lived. You can join us this hour. Are you there for the lush soul of Italy, Verdi, for the stern soul of Germany, Wagner? Or where do you come down? Rigoletto, or the Valkyries, maybe sweet humanism, or thunder of the gods? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Peter Conrad joins us from London, great cultural critic there. Peter, we have a lot of response online already. Let me share just a little bit of it here. Lou Marconi, Italian name, Verdi with three exclamation marks. He's all for it. On the other hand, here's another who says, Judy says, as Mark Twain said, Wagner's music is better than it sounds. Gives us something to think about, kind of a Zen cone there.
Yeah, poor old Mark Twain went to Bayreuth, the opera festival that Wagner founded in Germany, and sat through 6 hours of Parsifal and said at the end of it, you get almost too much value for your money, he said.
that's Twain. Judy writes to us here, both geniuses, but Wagner crushes me, she writes. As a rabbi once wrote to the New York Times, Wagner is proof of God's existence, as only he would use such a flawed to be kind person to create such music, absolutely transcendent. And she writes, favorite Wagner moment, so hard, but if I must pick one, the final scene of the Valkyrie, quoting there, only one will free the bride, one freer than I, the god.
Yeah, that's
Wagner. But we've got Verdi in our ears right here, and it's so beautiful. Just brings you to tears.
I was thinking when you were playing that, I didn't recognize it for the first few seconds, and then panicked a bit and finally figured it out. I mean, it's a sort of lullaby that Gilda, the young girl in Rigoletto, who dies at the end of the opera, it's Joan Sutherland singing, is singing to herself. I mean, she drifts off to sleep, dreaming of this young man that she's fantasizing about. But it's so typical of Verdi to write music for that moment when all of us, at the end of each day, are between consciousness and unconsciousness, and we want to project ourselves into the night and give ourselves calm sleep and sweet dreams and so on. I mean, it's really, you know, kind of beautifully consoling music, singing you to sleep and singing a kind of reassurance to you.
We want to get synced up with your themes. You say two men, two worlds, two centuries. You began to give us the two men with Verdi. Tell us about these two men.
What I was saying, is that you suggested that they typified their nationalities, and that's the myth, the legend about both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there was nothing very Latin about Verdi. He was a very sober and self-controlled and straight-laced, business-like sort of person. And as for Wagner, well, when you think of the German character, you think of something very, you know, kind of downright and doughty and unhumorous and equable somehow. I mean, Wagner was a total hysteric, a total neurotic, you know, was living between extremes of ecstasy and despair the whole time. And there was nothing at all Teutonic about Wagner. I mean, that for me was the fascination, that as individuals, they are so unlike the national stereotype.
And yet, Wagner gave Germans, or maybe found in somewhere in his root ball of German culture, this sort of Übermensch, Teutonic notion, you know, beyond the dowdy life, something extraordinarily grand, almost dangerously grand.
Very dangerously grand, I think. I mean, if you follow the afterlife of Wagner through the 20th century and find him becoming the favorite composer of the Third Reich. I mean, it has to be said, I think, that Hitler and his supporters, Hitler and the Wagnerites in Germany in the 1930s and 40s, you know, misused and misinterpreted Wagner. I mean, they were very, very selective in the little bits that they took, little, you know, kind of mottos of victory. I mean, constantly playing the, you know, the theme of the sword, or which represents victory for Siegfried. And yet there is a kind of darkness in that music, which, is bequeathed Germany a bit of a nightmare in the 20th century. And what's really interesting is during those years when Germany was being Wagnerized by the Nazis, Verdi came to the aid of the liberal opposition, and there were some very brave opera administrators, conductors, and translators in Berlin and other cities who put on operas by Verdi, emphasizing their liberalism, their sympathy for the underdog, their sympathy for victims, and until they were prevented from performing the works of this person whose nationality was thought to be inferior. Although Mussolini, interestingly, tried to ingratiate with Hitler by adopting Wagner as his great enthusiasm, and was a little bit embarrassed by Verdi because he thought that Verdi was a remnant of an old-fashioned Italy before the trains were made to run on time.
So
but even in the 1930s, there was this bit of a war going on between the totalitarian Wagner and the liberal, sympathetic Verdi, whose case was being pressed by people like Franz Werfel, who was the last husband of Alma Mahler, died in California in the 40s or early 50s, wrote a wonderful novel about Verdi, which presents Verdi as a kind of Tolstoy, I mean, a kind of wise, prophetic socialist.
People really, lining up on both sides.
Concern for the welfare of the peasants on his estate, concern for the amelioration of humanity, rather than with this mad vision of messianic heroism that Hitler got from Wagner.
It's really interesting to think there in those historical terms of sectors in the two countries themselves dipping into the others for some triumphalism or some humanism. And, of course, people lining up across the generations on both sides. Stravinsky, despairing of Wagner's Götterdämmerung with its, he said, fat people in horns and hides. Auden saying Wagner had the sartorial taste of a drag queen. Verdi, on the other hand, a genius and a gentleman. Peter Conrad is with us, the great Peter Conrad from London. His new book is Verdi and/or Wagner. Peter, let me go to our listeners, if I may. They are calling in. Bill in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I'm an amateur chorister and an amateur violinist, and choosing between these two is impossible. I love them both. I do have a comment for Mr. Conrad. I love the music. I love the songs, the singing. However, when I hear, especially Wagner, on the radio, I tend not to be able to listen to the whole opera because I'm driven to distraction by what I think is the overuse of vibrato in contemporary art song, classical music.
Which sort of amps the emotionality up even higher, Bill.
Mm.
Vibrato was used, if I understand correctly, to fill the unamplified spaces in Italy 100 years ago to great effect. Today, I just hear it as over-singing. Your comments, sir.
Interesting. Peter Conrad.
I know there's a controversy about this. It's a bit too technical for me to have an opinion about it. I thought that what you were going to say when you said that you found it hard to go on listening to Wagner if you heard an excerpt on the radio was that, you know, I mean, you've got a life. You weren't prepared to sit down and listen for 6 or 7 hours the way Wagner wants you to. I mean, he does want to overtake you. I mean, and to terrorize you into subjection in a way, I suppose. I mean, when people complained that they found his music boring, he was very pleased because he thought that, you know, that meant that he had really colonized their minds and taken them out of their own reality into his. But I suppose, yeah, I mean, the excessive vibrato is, I suppose, one of the weapons that this music uses, that you know, amps the music up, as Tom was saying. I mean, this is music that doesn't ever whisper in our ear. I mean, it's music that wants to shout us down.
Bill, for you then, let me give you a little Wagner with no vibrato, no vocals at all. Here's some of the prelude to Tristan and Isolde. On it goes. Talk about the tension, the long pauses there. 1859, Tristan and Isolde. I mean, here, this is not the horned helmets and the breastplates, Peter. This is the intimacy, obsession, and as it unfolds, eroticism.
Sure, but this is the music that gave Europe a nervous breakdown at the end of the 19th century. I mean, that unresolved discord, I mean, that you hear after the first pause and the way in which that suggests a world of obsessive eroticism, you know, it's the music of almost post-coital fatigue, isn't it? It's interesting the uses that can be made of this music. There's a new film by the Danish director Lars von Trier, Melancholia, which is just open in the United States, in which the first 10 minutes are set to this prelude from Tristan and Isolde, and what they visualize, what they show you on screen, is the end of the world. As a small planet jumps out of its accustomed orbit and remorselessly moves towards the Earth and creates an explosion which terminates all life on Earth at the end of the 10 minutes. It's unsettling music. I mean, it's music that absolutely obsessed the first generations who heard it, and it's this music with that unresolved discord that really made possible modernity in music, because it broke all of the classical rules and allowed people to just completely reconceive the art. The generation of Schoenberg and Berg and Webern in Vienna were all created by that discordant chord that you hear at the beginning of the prelude.
Let's go to Harbor Springs, Michigan, and Anne. Anne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
To me, the difference between Wagner and Verdi is that you have to bring your intellect to Wagner like you would to a study of mythology or esotericism, whereas Verdi is all heart. Verdi has the power to heal what hurts, even if it's through a sort of a cathartic experience.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. I mean, I've always been puzzled when people talk about catharsis in tragedy and in Shakespeare, because, you know, you get to the end of a Shakespeare play, I mean, you feel all sorts of things, but I don't feel that I'm kind of purged in the way that the theory of catharsis says that I should be. But when I listen to Verdi, I know exactly what that means. And I think Verdi knew as well. I mean, that's why tears are so important in his operas. I mean, you know, the characters often sing about the tears that they shed, which are sometimes tears of remorse, sometimes tears of sympathy and commiseration and pity, sometimes tears of joy. And we're shedding them in the audience, too. I absolutely agree with what Anne is saying, that, you know, one speaks to the heart. As Beethoven said about his music, this is addressed to the heart. This is addressed from the heart to the heart. And the mind, which is what you need to understand Wagner, is a bit of a kind of optional extra.
And as you say, Peter Conrad, people may start off thinking of them as just kind of stereotypes of their cultures, but they take the heart and the mind off in all kinds of incredible, incredible directions. Let's hear a little more Verdi. This is from Verdi's great Requiem, Leontine Price with the Libera Me. Peter Conrad, speak to the Verdi we hear here in his great Requiem.
Well, that goes to the very essence of what it is to be human and to be frightened of the darkness that lies outside human life, really. I mean, this is a mass for the dead. But Verdi added this section to it, the Libera Me, with which the Requiem ends, which he got from another liturgy. It doesn't come from the church Requiem service at all. And probably the reason that Verdi was interested in it was that it's full of fear and panic. It's not the music of someone who has faith and is absolutely convinced that there is life after death. It's the music of someone who wants to be freed from the fear of death, which is what Libera Me means. Leontine Price sings mm-hmm. that wonderfully
Save
consoling,
me.
Angelic mm-hmm. high note, but then immediately goes back to this gabble terror, I mean, when she's speaking about her fear. And the chorus is singing in Latin about the day of wrath when the heavens and the earth will shake and move. And you can hear all of that happening in the orchestra. I mean, it's very unlike the description of the end of the world that you got in that piece of music from the end of Götterdämmerung, with which you began, where the world ends in this great explosion of sound, this ocean of sound which washes away all human life, and you no longer think about individual fates. I mean, this is a view of the end which concentrates on what a particular individual, who could be any of us, is feeling.
Talk about vast imaginations and vast heart, both in these in these two composers.
I mean, it's an interesting thing for Verdi to have done, to have written a Requiem Mass, because he was not a believer by any means. I mean, I suspect he was an atheist, although he passed as a sort of agnostic, to the dismay of his wife, who was a churchgoer. He used to drive her to church in the carriage and then tell her to give your God my compliments, he would say, and wait for her outside. I mean, he wasn't able to accept the consolation of religion, but that, I think, is what made him able to sympathize with the fear and uncertainty that we all feel,
Peter Conrad's,
about our own mortality.
Stand by right there, if you'd be so kind, in London.
Sure.
Peter Conrad's wonderful new book, Verdi and or Wagner, Two Men, Two Worlds, Two Centuries. Listeners, you can join us. Where do you come down? Rigoletto or Valkyries, Sweet Humanism, The Thunder of the Gods, Requiem. Here's Finale from Verdi's Falstaff. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the two great opera composers, Giuseppe Verdi, Richard Wagner. Peter Conrad is with us, the wonderful cultural critic from London. His new book is Verdi and/or Wagner, Two Men, Two Worlds, Two Centuries, the German, the Italian, two greats, and their different visions, who contended and competed while they lived. We'll look at that. You can join the conversation. Where do you come down, or do you just embrace both, finally? And who's held up better for our times, our dreams? Verdi? Wagner? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Wagner behind us, right there. What are we listening to, Peter?
I think it's Jesse Norman hallooing in The Flying Dutchman, singing about the storm at sea.
Yo-ho, yo-e,
yo-ho, yo-e, yes. And trying to root the violence of the tempest through her body so that she becomes the storm. And she's describing the storm-tossed journey of this cursed character, the Flying Dutchman, whom she's fallen in love with by reading about the legend and looking at a portrait of him. And it's a kind of, you know, witchy sort of thing, because she sings this ballad about him which summons him up. And then at the end of the ballad, he walks through the door. It's almost as if, you know, I mean, she has conjured him up like a magician. And the two of them look at one another instantly and, of course, you know, are fatally allied from that moment. This is the way Eros works in Wagner, I think.
We have a lot of response online here. Mike says, you know, let's be careful of characterizing Wagner too narrowly. He says, I find a deep, moving human element in many Wagner operas where mortals, sometimes heroes, are contending with forces that are out of their control. Destiny, The Ring, Love, Tristan. And Carolyn says, love Verdi and Wagner. Says, when it comes to powerful women, Wagner is it. He certainly has strong female characters who have quite an influence on the action, whether in The Ring or the other operas, summoning life right there. Jeff says, we blissfully lower creatures can be awed by both. And there's no question of that. Let's go to Carolyn in Lexington, Kentucky. Carolyn, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Peter Conrad.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Peter. Nice to talk to you.
Hi.
You too.
For me, well, you may hear from my voice, I'm actually German,
Okay.
I grew up with both Verdi and Wagner and used to sing some mezzo myself in my misspent youth and like to sing both. So far, I've been listening to you both, and I'm kind of thinking that you might be doing Wagner a bit of a disservice by defining him so narrowly in the term of the Ring cycle. And that actually when you listen to some of his other stuff like Meistersänger or Tristan und Isolde or Tannhäuser, you get a bit of a different impression of him than you do of the Ring cycle. It's not all violence and bloodshed and storms and everything else.
Although in Tristan there is such, you know, I mean, kind of tremendous obsessiveness and emotional exhaustion somehow. You know, I mean, everyone is dead at the end of that opera as well. They're all worn out by their nerves and by the frenzies of their emotions. I don't know. I mean, I love them both as well, but I love them in very, very different ways, which is why I called the book Verdi and/or Wagner, to admit the impossibility of making a choice. They just work on you in very different ways, it seems to me. I mean, Verdi a bit like a drug, Wagner a bit like a drug, like an opiate, something that really gets into your bloodstream and causes you to lie awake at night. But there's a kind of vitality and exhilaration to Verdi, which you heard in that finale from the comic opera Falstaff that we played a bit of just before the last break, that operates in a sort of tonic way, like a kind of vitamin. I mean, they just appeal to different aspects of one's experience, you know, to the light and the darkness, I suppose, in everyone's experience.
Though there's surely, Carolyn, yes, indeed, there's crossover. They work in each other's terrain, no question sometimes. Here's Chaz writes to us, says, Wagner's best music for me is on a plane of sheer marvel, and writes, and I say this as a lover also of Bach and Beethoven and Brahms. What did they know of each other in their lifetimes? How did they relate to one another, Peter?
Well, they stalked one another through the 19th century, really. I mean, each was obviously very well aware of the other. It was lucky that the Alps were between them, although Wagner spent increasing amounts of time escaping from the German winters at the end of his life in Italy, and he, in fact, died in Venice. But Verdi kept a very beady eye on Wagner in the distance and was always asking people to send him copies of Wagner's essays that were published abroad when they were published in French translation. For instance, I don't think he could read German. And when people thought to curry favor with Verdi by lamenting the fact that Wagner's music was so difficult and so unmelodic, I mean, Verdi would always make out a case for Wagner, saying, well, you know, poor thing, we can't all be Italians. I mean, he doesn't have the native genius of lyricism that all of us have. I mean, he was very curious about Wagner. The best story about his interest in Wagner, I think, is when Lohengrin, Wagner's early chivalric opera, was first performed in Italy, in Bologna. Verdi made the long journey to Bologna to hear it, but he made the journey incognito and sat in the back of a box, out of sight, not even looking at the stage, following the opera with an open score and writing in the margin things like matto, meaning mad. I mean, he disapproved or didn't understand the music. But then in the intermission, someone spotted him from the orchestra level of the theater, and there was a huge ovation for him, which was obvious because he was a national hero. Verdi was very, very annoyed because he'd been caught out a bit as the beta male in the audience listening to the music of Wagner, the alpha male. Then at the end of his life, I mean, he was furious when people said about him, oh, you know, Verdi is getting better in his old age because he's heard a lot of Wagner and is now learning from Wagner's example. I mean, Wagner's attitude to Verdi was much simpler. I mean, he just scoffed at him and dismissed him as a kind of organ grinder. And there was one moment in the diary of Cosima Wagner, Wagner's loyal wife, where she describes a discussion after dinner with one of their musical friends who was claiming that Italian composers were not as bad as they were thought to be in the Wagner circle, and saying that, you know, Verdi, after all, is not all that much worse than Donizetti. And poor Cosima Wagner was so horrified by this, by the impiety of this opinion, that she had to go upstairs and lie down. I mean, she was just driven to distraction by the thought that someone had praised Verdi in Wagner's hearing. But Verdi, you know, was a sympathetic man with an open mind. Yeah. Wagner was one of the greatest geniuses in the history of art, but was well aware of it and was not very interested in the productions of anyone else, really.
Let's listen to just a little bit of Verdi's Otello, where he's maybe echoing Wagner a little bit. His Act 4, Verdi's Otello. Otello, they're dying, kissing Desdemona, who he's killed of jealousy. 1947 radio broadcast from the NBC Symphony Orchestra. I mean, there are even more Wagnerian moments of great timpani drums and all the rest. But what about the thought that he took on some Wagnerian coloring in sometimes later?
Yeah, and the supposedly Wagnerian thing there is the motif, the fact that the words about the kiss and the melody about the kiss are a reminiscence of a love duet that Otello and Desdemona sing together at the beginning of the opera, at the height of their happiness. And people listening to the opera when it was first performed all claimed that this was Verdi's submission to Wagner, that he'd finally adopted the Wagnerian method. I don't think so at all. I mean, I think the motif works differently in Verdi from Wagner. There's a quality of pain and in that sigh of grief and distress, but also a sigh of joy and pleasure in the remembrance of that happiness at the point of death. Whereas the motifs in Wagner, there are so many more of them, and they are dragging us back into the past the whole time, pointing out that the characters are unable to escape from their pasts. Also, I mean, when Wagnerian characters die, they are happy to die. They die in delight. They die ecstatically. Tristan tears the bandages off his wound so that he won't be reunited in life with Isolde at the end of Tristan and Isolde, because for them, the real consummation is in death. Whereas what you hear in that Verdi excerpt is the absolutely inconsolable misery of death that has divided these people from one another and has shown that they never really understood each other when they were alive. And Verdi is enough of a humanist to lament death, whereas Wagner sees death as the consummation of life. I mean, when he and Cosima, his wife, moved to Bayreuth, the town where he established his opera festival, they designed and built a sepulchre for themselves in the back garden of the house, and the shared grave was ready before the house was. And they often used to sit around in the house while the building works continued, saying to one another, I mean, Wagner would say to Cosima, "When shall we go down to our grave, my dear?" And she would say, "Whenever you please, master." The grave was the bed for them.
Chris writes to us, Peter, from Pennsylvania. "I can understand the claim that Verdi's music is a deep and intimate view of love and the human spirit, but we should never forget the themes of redemption through love, so prevalent in Wagner, Brunhilde, Siegfried, Tannhäuser, Lohengrin, and Elsa. The list goes on." Let's get a little, we talked about the political Wagner a little bit, or the politicization. There's a political Verdi, too. Here's the patriotic chorus from Nabucco. This is a 2011 release. Nabucco there, conducted by Riccardo Muti. This is the chorus and orchestra of the La Scala Opera House in Milan. Opera, of course, based on the biblical story of Nebuchadnezzar and their "Fly My Thoughts on Wings of Gold," sung in the opera by the Israelites captive in Babylon, yearning for their homeland. Peter Conrad, it's become a kind of unofficial national anthem for Italy.
Yes, it has. I mean, in the 19th century, it was always encored, because Italians listening to it realized that it was the confession of their longing to occupy their own homeland, to own their own land, rather than being a province of the Austrian Empire. And nowadays, I mean, it's equally popular, if not more popular. I mean, all Italians can sing it, and they usually cry while singing it as well, because it reminds them of the dream of an ideal country which didn't have a Berlusconi for its prime minister and didn't have cruise ship captains who jump into the lifeboat while the passengers are drowning. I mean, it reminds them of a vision of a kind of paradise lost, really. And it's a wonderful piece, I mean, which even Riccardo Muti used quite recently in a public performance in Rome. I mean, he allowed an encore, which is not something that he ever does. But he turned to the audience and, accepting the desire for an encore, conducted it himself, and then said before the encore, which the audience joined in, this is the music of our protest against conditions in Italy at the moment. This is music that enables us to remember a time when Italy was a great country.
Your title has an unusual and slash or in it, but I think the and wins out in the end, Peter Conrad.
Well, you know, I mean, Verdi appeals to the best of me, I think, if I have a best side. I mean, it appeals to the humane side of me, the affectionate side of me, the side of me that's interested in other people. I mean, there's a dark appeal that Wagner has as well, which is extremely strong and intense. I think it's about 50-50.
By the end of their lives, you write, they had turned into incarnations of their times, the zeitgeist made flesh, and that took us where?
Well, took us into the 20th century when they continued their struggle, really. I mean, and what one really wants is to make peace between them and to be able to have them both, I suppose. But as Anne said when she was on the line, I mean, Verdi is the one we will always need because he's speaking from the eternal human heart. Wagner is the one whom we, in a way, can't escape from because he's the one who gives voice to all of these nervous frenzies and this hysteria and ecstasy, which is also, and this destructiveness, which is also part of our human nature and which also demands to be heard.
Peter Conrad, it's been absolute pleasure to have you with us today. We appreciate your time and your new work. It's wonderful. You bring it all back and make it new again. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It was wonderful to hear the music.
Peter Conrad joining us from London. His new book is Verdi and/or Wagner, Two Men, Two Worlds, Two Centuries. We'll go out with the final moments of Wagner's final opera, Parsifal, as James Levine conducting the 1994 Metropolitan Opera Orchestra into the finish as a white dove descends to hover over the head of the hero, Parsifal. Curtains come to a close. Our special thanks today to Lena Serpa and the Boston University Music Library for their help providing music for this show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.